From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today on the program, a great mystery. It's the lost colony of Roanoke. In 1590, about 100 English settlers pretty much vanished from a settlement in what is now North Carolina. At least that's the story, one that captured the imagination of the journalist Andrew Lawler. Turns out a lot of people are fascinated by the lost colony, and it's the perfect myth for what it means to be an American. Join us after this.
Do you have an old station wagon full of memories and a busted transmission? Yeah, join the club. Give that car, or any car, a new lease on life by donating it to KUER. We'll have it picked up for you, so really it couldn't be easier. Then we split the proceeds with our car donation partner, and the money goes straight into the programming you love to listen to in the car. It's a regular public radio circle of life. Look under the support tab at KUER.org to learn more about car donation.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. In 1587, Sir Walter Raleigh left 115 English settlers on an island off the coast of what is now North Carolina, Roanoke Island. In his book, the journalist Andrew Lawler says they were people of no particular distinction. They were tradesmen and lawyers and shopkeepers, you know, middle-class folks. Raleigh had something grand in mind. These people were supposed to build a village, and maybe more than one, with churches and town halls and farms and houses. But they vanished. All 115 of them. They disappeared. When expeditions returned a few years later, they were just gone. And over the years, amateurs and professionals have scoured the area. A few clues have been found. There are archaeologists today looking, but right now, it's still a mystery. And Andrew Lawler wanted to know why. Why the story of the lost colony of Roanoke still fascinates people. Lawler is coming to Salt Lake City next week, so we're rebroadcasting our conversation with him about the lost colony of Roanoke. His book is called The Secret Token. Lawler is a journalist who writes about archaeology, history, and science for publications like National Geographic, Smithsonian, The New York Times. He joined us back in 2013 to talk about chickens. It was the subject of his first book. He joined us from Blue Ridge Public Radio in Asheville, North Carolina, and we began the conversation with that moment this story became a mystery.
In 1590, Governor John White, who had led the colonists who had landed in 1587 on Roanoke Island, got back finally to Roanoke. It had taken him 3 long years because war with Spain had broken out, and that had made it extremely difficult for him to cross the ocean. He tried, in fact, twice before without success. But when he arrives in 1590, so 3 years after he's left the colonists, and no one has had any information about what's happened to the settlers, he encounters a lot of strange things. He sees smoke signals that seem to indicate that there are people there watching him. When he finally lands on Roanoke on the third birthday of his granddaughter, Virginia Dare, the first English child born in the New World, he spots footprints in the sand. He's being followed. He's being watched. He sees more fires, more evidence of smoke, but he can't seem to find any evidence of the colonists or anybody else. When he finally reaches the settlement, which is the place where they had built the city of Raleigh there on Roanoke Island, he encounters silence. The settlement is intact, largely, although some of the houses have been taken apart or taken down. There's no sign of massacre, no sign of burning, no signs of graves. The place is utterly deserted. Now, there is one important clue that he does record, and that is at the entrance to the fort, to the settlement, is a post, and on that post is carved the word Croatoan.
Yeah.
Now, this word was not mysterious at all to John White, although it might sound like a strange word to us. It was simply the name of the island and the people who lived on it about 50 miles to the south. Today, we call that island Hatteras. So John White naturally thought, great, the settlers are Croatoan. That's not a bad place to be because those Indians actually were quite friendly to the English. They were allied to these newcomers. So he was hopeful that he would be able to find them once he was able to leave Roanoke. But, of course, John White is a man of terrible luck. Yeah. And as soon as they get on the ships that evening, the storm blows up that eventually forces them to leave the coast. And John White, as far as we know, never was able to return to the New World. Mm.
What do you make of that that particular story? When did you first hear that particular story?
Well, I've known this story since I was young, since it was very much part of the Lost Colony story that I grew up with. But the more I read the actual account, so all we have of this voyage is this account by John White. We don't have anybody else's viewpoint. So when you read it, it gets stranger and stranger.
Yeah.
Like, what are these fires? Are they man-made or are they caused by lightning? John White doesn't say. Mm. Who was leaving these footprints in the sand? He doesn't say. Why, after spending 3 years trying to reach the New World, to desperately return to his colonists and to his daughter and granddaughter who were stranded there— why does he only stay on the island for a few hours before going back to the ship?
Yeah.
And then, of course, the big question, why does he leave? But, you know, it's even stranger because prior to arriving off the coast of Roanoke Island on the Outer Banks of North Carolina, he actually does stop at Croatoan. This is the really peculiar detail which a lot of historians haven't noted. Mm. So on their way up from the Caribbean— they actually, the two ships that White is part of, they stop right off Croatoan, and they actually take a boat and go into the inlet that separates Croatoan from Hatteras Island, and they make soundings. So they're taking note of depths. And if they did this, as John White reports, then they were within eyeshot and certainly earshot of a large Native American village that existed there. Now, why John White didn't stop and ask the locals what happened to the colonists, and why he doesn't mention the locals at all. He doesn't mention the Croatoan, doesn't mention seeing anybody. He doesn't mention how odd it would be not to see someone on this island that he had visited before.
Yeah.
So this is one of these strange details that makes this account completely perplexing.
You say John White's account of it has a hallucinatory quality to it. It just seems mysterious and strange.
Absolutely. It's almost as if he's writing in this disembodied way. You don't get a sense that he's really focused on the task at hand. He seems to be walking through this in a kind of sleep, which seems very strange for somebody who was very savvy about the New World. He traveled to the New World many times. He'd been on innumerable expeditions. He was a very savvy, experienced traveler. He was not a first-time person who would have been stunned or shocked by the strangeness, by the alien nature of this new land. So that makes it even more puzzling. It almost seems that he's covering up something or not telling us the whole story. Mm. But of course, his is the only story that we have.
We'll get to this more intriguing element of whether there was some sort of cover-up. Let's back up and talk about that initial interest that you mentioned, a personal connection to the story. Your childhood vacations to the Outer Banks, and you would go to the Fort Raleigh National Historic Site on Roanoke Island, and this is when you first encountered the mystery of it. Were you taken by that when you were a kid?
Oh, yes. This was the ultimate ghost story that was told in my childhood, the ultimate mystery. You have 115 men, women, and children who simply vanished. And there's no record of what happened to them. So that, as a child, was very intriguing, particularly since I knew that landscape and we spent a lot of time there. So it was kind of part and parcel of my childhood that this was a mystery that had not been solved and that maybe someday would be. But at that point, nobody had any real new evidence other than these historical accounts that had been kicking around for centuries.
You tell of this encounter you had not so long ago with a British archaeologist. You were in England at the time, and you meet this archaeologist named Mark Horton. And you ask him, I think just kind of offhandedly, you had heard that he had been doing some work in the Outer Banks region, and you wondered, had he found the lost colony of Roanoke? Tell that story, if you would, because this seems to be part of what got you started on this journey.
Yeah, so about 3 or 4 years ago, I was covering a conference in Oxford in England on Indian Ocean archaeology, and I crashed the speaker's dinner and was sitting across from an archaeologist, and to be polite, you know, what do you ask an archaeologist to break the ice? Of course, you know, where do you dig? And he said, oh, I'm digging in Zanzibar. I'm like, oh, okay, that's interesting, makes sense, along the Indian Ocean. He said, also in this little place called Hatteras. And I said, Hatteras Island? He said, well, yes, have you heard of it? I said, well, indeed, I grew up in that area. I said, well, have you found the lost colony? Yeah. Because, of course, I knew that Croatoan, that clue of where they had gone, is today's Hatteras. And he said, well, as a matter of fact, we have found them. And that stunned me because I had read nothing in the press. And he asked me who I was. And as soon as he discovered that I was a reporter, he clammed up, refused to speak to me, and then vanished for more than a year. Yeah. I tracked him down finally and managed to convince him to let me come visit his dig. So that reawakened my childhood interest in what seemed like a mystery that would never be solved.
You say that you first started thinking about writing this story as a science writer, but it seems like the way you've been thinking about it changed.
Yes, it began as a mystery that science could solve. Yeah. And as a science writer, I thought, okay, now we have archaeologists who are on the case. Now, understand that the story of the lost colony has been a historian's game for more than four centuries. Yeah. As I mentioned, all we have are these documents left behind. There's been no archaeological evidence. So as soon as I discovered that there was two, not just one team, that was actively searching for really hard physical evidence of the colony, I thought, well, great. Finally, we're going to get some answers.
When you told people that you were interested in this story, a lot of eye rolling. People were what? Skeptical. Explain that.
Well, the Lost Colony has a certain reputation among reputable historians as something that is kind of left for those who are obsessive who have nothing else better to do than to try and solve an unsolvable mystery. So, you know, academics have kind of left Roanoke in the dust, so to speak. They don't really see it as a very important venture. They see it as something that failed. And worse than that, it's something that, because of its mystery, has become wildly popular in pop culture. And that is just anathema to a lot of academics who have just avoided the entire area. So when I would bring up that I was, you know, poking around in this area, they would roll their eyes because it wasn't seen as a really credible scientific effort.
But where you develop this idea, it's more than just a mystery of these people, but it represents something much larger. And I wanted to say something about this idea of how the lost colony, quote unquote lost, it really didn't become, quote-unquote, lost until the 19th century, which revealed something about this story and our identity as Americans. Talk about that bigger theme that you found.
Well, the lost colony, as we talk about it today, was forgotten for more than two centuries, almost two and a half centuries. People really didn't pay much attention to it. There were new settlers arriving. There were other challenges to be faced. And what was seen as a failed effort was vaguely embarrassing. I mean, well, I don't know. They vanished and maybe they died and we don't really know, but let's move on. And it wasn't until the 19th century that the lost colony was reimagined or really resurrected as something more, as a romantic mystery that needed solving.
You say one of the crucial questions is that this illustrated what it means to be an American. What do you mean by that?
Well, the more I dug into the actual history of the Roanoke Ventures, the more I realized that they were actually the effort was very critical to the foundation of this country. In a sense, the Roanoke Ventures are our creation story. It's the place mm-hmm. where the English first decided to try and settle the New World and where they chose an area, the North Atlantic coast, and where they actually made the effort. And not only that, they created the model, the template, if you will, for all of the successful settlements that followed, which included men, women, and children, which included a corporation where people would put money into the effort, and therefore it was a venture that involved lots of people, not just a few wealthy people who have hired mercenaries. So it was really the beginning of our nation in a way that I think historians have not fully appreciated.
The thing that's going on at that particular time is, of course, this tension, struggle between the Spanish crown and the English crown. And the Spanish, they thought of this new world as theirs. They had explored it. They had claimed it. I think we have to understand that context to help understand kind of the mystery of some of this.
Absolutely. Well, first, let's be clear that there were Native Americans, of course, throughout the Americas. And in this particular area were in North Carolina, what's now North Carolina, were people who were Carolina Algonquin speakers. They had moved down, migrated from the north. But yes, when the Spanish arrived in the 16th century on the mainland of North America, they claimed it as their own. They considered it to be Spanish territory, not just Florida, but also as far north as what is today North Carolina and Virginia. So from the Spanish perspective, these English were not just trespassing, they were also trying to destroy the Spanish Empire. How? Well, the Gulf Stream that moves along Atlantic coast, moving up from Florida, then moves offshore around the Outer Banks. So Spanish ships that were bringing gold and silver and spices and you name it from the Orient as well as from the Caribbean and Mexico and Peru were moving up the Gulf Stream, and the English intended to build a pirate base that would be able to capture Spanish ships. So this was not only English trespassing in the eyes of the Spanish, it was a threat to the jugular vein of the Spanish Empire.
What did the English have in mind? What was the concept? And we should introduce Sir Walter Raleigh. He plays a large role here. Give us a sense of what it is that Raleigh was thinking about and John White was thinking about.
Well, the Roanoke Venture was a little bit like the space station. Nobody could really agree what it was for. Everybody had their own idea of what the purpose was. Raleigh, Sir Walter Raleigh, was from minor gentry and skyrocketed to the Queen's favor, to the favor of Queen Elizabeth I in the early 1580s. And he took advantage of that and said, hey, we should try and get a piece of this new world pie. Now, his goal was to get rich and also to be able to show the world that England was not just a minor power, but that it had the ability to establish colonies overseas. It didn't have any at that time except for Ireland. Spain, by contrast, was a vast global empire. So the English wanted to get in on the game of the New World. They wanted to find gold and silver. They also wanted to find pharmaceuticals. We tend to forget this, but at that time, you know, people were dying of plague and a thousand other diseases, and the New World was thought to be this pharmacopoeia that could provide a lot of cures to illnesses that were ravaging Europe and England in that day. They also, as I mentioned, wanted to be able to attack Spanish ships. And if you had a base on the East Coast, you could duck out into the Gulf Stream, grab a Spanish ship, and become a millionaire, if not a billionaire in today's terms, in a moment. So all of these desires were wrapped up into the Roanoke Ventures.
They were, you say, mostly middle-class people of no particular distinction who went in that first group. Not a single portrait of any of them, you say. And you write this, you say that the lost colonists seem ordinary in a way that makes them more familiar than, for example, the settlers of Jamestown or the pilgrims at Plymouth. The settlers in Plymouth were kind of religious fanatics in some ways. The settlers of Jamestown were interested in gold, but the settlers in Roanoke, they were more ordinary. I found that interesting.
Yeah, in a way, the people who were part of the 1587 expedition that became known as the Lost Colony were much more like those people who came later to American shores. They were people looking to start a new life. They didn't expect to find treasure. They were expecting to find some land. They wanted to be able to trade with Native Americans and be able to establish self-sustaining settlements. You know, they really were not
interested as much in exploring or in being conquistadors. Rather, they really wanted to settle down and live there. And this is the model that ultimately became the one that worked for the English in settling the Americas.
Yeah. You say they make good blank slates.
Well, they do. I mean, we know a little bit about them. In recent years, there's been some new historical research which does show that these people were not the poor farmers or even people, you know, released from prison that past generations thought they were. In fact, they were, as you mentioned, they were middle-class people for the most part. They were people from London. They were shopkeepers. They were cops. They were professors. They were people who had money, enough money to invest in a new life. They wanted to get out of London. It was a crowded, expensive place, much like it is today, except when you add plague into it. And people really wanted to get out of Dodge, and they were willing to take their life savings and put it into an effort to start a new life in a very, very different place. And that is something that we didn't really understand until recently.
Mm. Let's talk more about John White. I was fascinated by him. You mentioned the kind of conflicting way of thinking about him. On one hand, he is this idealist. He's brave. He's an amazing artist, actually. But also not that great as a governor, not that great as a military commander. He's a really interesting figure.
Yes, one of the many mysteries of the Lost Colony is why Walter Raleigh put him in charge of a colony.
Yeah.
Clearly, he was, as you say, he was a great artist. The paintings, the watercolors that he did of the Native Americans that he encountered, these were the Carolina Algonquin-speaking locals, are really extraordinary. They give us an image of these people that doesn't seem to be tinged by idealism.
Yeah.
Or they're not painted as barbarians. They're really painted as they were. They seem quite accurate. And they betray somebody who's very empathetic to a different culture and who clearly loved that culture because he kept wanting to go back to the New World. So that is a side of John White that I think is really, you know, quite amazing. He also braved the Atlantic several times at a time when most people wouldn't even get on a ship in those days. It was quite dangerous. So he does have that element of bravery. And yet, at the same time, he seems to be somebody who was not a leader of men or women or children, for that matter.
Yeah.
He seemed not really able to understand the threat that he faced when the colonists arrived in 1587 on the island. And he was really ineffective in trying to find a way for the colonists to live peacefully with the Native Americans, despite the empathy he clearly had.
Yeah. You mentioned his paintings, the way he drew the Algonquins, how they dressed, how they fixed their hair, and how these images were kind of you say they were a rare glimpse into this society at first contact. Before, as you say, we kind of tacked on a racial perspective or a kind of ideology. Is this the thing that gave Europeans the idea of the noble savage in some ways, though?
Yes, and what happened was John White, he did these paintings. Now, remember, the Spanish and Portuguese had been making paintings of the New World for a long, long time, for nearly a century. But the difference was that they weren't often published. They were often held as state secrets in Spain, in the archives in Spain and Portugal. So the general public in Europe really had very little idea of who these people were in this New World. John White's drawings were transferred. They were turned into etchings, engravings by a Belgian engraver, and they were published in the first book in a series of books about the New World. And because they were first, because the series became a bestseller, these paintings took on an extraordinary significance. People began to envision all the inhabitants of the New World as looking like these Carolina Algonquins. And these images were used and reused for well over a century or two. It's really not until the great painters of the 19th century, Remington and others, that Americans and European, white Americans and Europeans began to get a more nuanced picture of the way the Native Americans looked in their time.
What was the search like for these lost colonists? It's interesting. You say people of England began to wonder, for example, if the Indians had fallen in love with all these beautiful English faces. And this idea that they had joined the indigenous people, that they had mixed and become part of them. What are the theories and what are the ideas that start to crop up as people wonder what happened to these people?
After John White's unsuccessful search and rescue mission in 1590, most people in England really forgot about the colonists. And the reason is obvious. There was war. The war with Spain continued well into the 1600s. So there really wasn't much attention or focus given to, you know, 100 or so odd English who were lost at a time when the country was fighting a desperate battle against the world's largest empire. And it wasn't until much later that people began to say, I wonder what happened to those folks. It really was the 19th century when there was a revival of interest in trying to solve what became seen as a mystery. Now, of course, what could have happened to them? Well, naturally, they might have died of starvation.
Yeah.
But if you think about it, if your refrigerator is empty and your car is out of gas, are you going to sit at home and starve? No. You probably will go to a neighbor's house and try to trade something, a tchotchke, whatever you might have around the house, for a meal. You might say, can I mow your grass? And you know, I think historians and anthropologists now are in agreement that that anybody in those circumstances would try and make do and try and join the local culture, which was very successful in surviving and thriving in that environment. So yes, they might have starved, but I think that seems unlikely. Now, massacre is another possibility, and not just by Native Americans, but by the Spanish, because as we've talked about, the Spanish were eager to wipe out what they saw as a nest of English pirates who were intent on destroying the Spanish. So it's possible, but the Spanish kept excellent records, and there's no record of them committing any such massacre. And we actually know that in 1588, a year after John White dropped the colonists at Roanoke, that a Spanish expedition stumbled on the port that was right on the barrier island near Roanoke. They didn't search further, but King Philip II, the head of Spain, was very focused on finding these people. And if he had, we would have record of it. So the other possibility, which can't really be proven, is could they have built a boat and sailed away? It's something that hasn't been talked about much, but certainly they had the capability to construct a vessel and to try and sail it either to England or up the coast to Newfoundland. If they did, then they obviously didn't make it because we have no record of them doing that. Of course, you can't prove that. You can't prove it unless you were to find a ship underwater and be able to identify it, which would be very difficult. So, there are lots of these possibilities that seem pretty clear but very, very difficult to prove.
Yeah.
And the one that seems to be the most in line with the new archaeological finds is that they did, in fact, assimilate with the Native Americans.
How fraught is that idea that they assimilated? How fraught did this idea that you had, at least from the perspective of different people along the line, you have, this kind of pure white race mixing with these savages. How did that element play into this story?
Well, I discovered that the fascinating story about the lost colony is that it reflects how we as Americans have viewed issues of race and immigration over the centuries. So as our view of the colonists have changed, they generally reflect the ways our own views of society have changed. So the Elizabethans, for example, as you mentioned earlier, they thought quite natural that these people just mixed with the locals. What's the big deal? But a century later, you start to see mentions of English who were in eastern North Carolina and saying, well, it looks like the lost colonists probably did assimilate, but you know, what a terrible thing and how degrading that would have been. So already you see this kind of shying away from accepting what actually seems kind of obvious. And then by the 19th century in this country, most states have laws preventing races from mixing. And I don't mean just African Americans and whites. I also mean Native Americans. You know, there was a strong prejudice against marrying Native Americans, against diluting the gene pool of the white majority. So it was a very hot topic. It was a big taboo. To talk about assimilation was to really call into question the whole social structure that developed, mainly in the South, but also in other parts of the country, that made it clear that the whites are on top and everybody else, the coloreds, that is, both African Americans, enslaved and free, as well as Native Americans, were on the bottom. Mm-hmm. And these laws were designed to keep these groups apart. So it was during this time in the 1830s, under the presidency of Andrew Jackson, that people began to talk about the colony being lost and a mystery that needed solving.
There are a couple of intriguing stories I wanted to just ask you about. There's a story you tell, actually, as a coda in the book from 1609. A Spanish ship is sailing along the coast of what is now North Carolina, looking for this English colony, for obvious reasons you've mentioned. Didn't want the English to establish a foothold in the New World. And they spot on land these seven Native Americans waving and shouting and making smoke signals, and then intriguingly playing flutes with these European tunes. What do you make of that story?
It's such a haunting image that's painted by the Spanish captain who wrote an account of this for King Philip III, King Philip II's son, who was by then in charge of Spain. So this is just 2 years after the settlement at Jamestown has been founded, just about 100 miles or so north of Roanoke Island. And at that point, the war between Spain and England was finally over, and Queen Elizabeth was dead, and King Philip II was dead, and the new generation made peace. And at the same time, the English are deciding, hey, it's time for us to restart our colonization ventures. And the Spanish are worried. They don't believe that they're going to necessarily face the kind of pirate threat they did earlier, but they still feel like this is their territory. So Philip III sent this expedition up the coast from St. Augustine to kind of check out these English settlers at Jamestown, which rumor had settled on the James River. And in the course of that, they were just coasting along the Outer Banks of North Carolina when they spotted these Native Americans who evidently wanted to get their attention. And yet, when the ship came in close to shore and the sailors shouted at the Native Americans, the Indians ran away as if they didn't want to have contact. And this went on and on, went back and forth. Very strange scene. And some historians speculate that if these Native Americans, in fact, were the descendants or actual lost colonists who had survived, then they might have been terrified to have encountered people speaking Spanish. Mm-hmm. They might have wanted to find an English ship or a Dutch ship, but not a Spanish ship. An interesting detail is the Spanish at that point were flying a Dutch flag in order to fool any English that they might encounter, because the Dutch and English at that point were allies, and Spanish were enemies of the Dutch. So it's an interesting detail that not only were the Native Americans likely to think this is a Dutch ship and therefore friendly to potential English colonists, but also that they were playing these flutes. And all we have is this brief mention by the Spanish captain that they were playing European melodies, European tunes, and that's all we know. But it certainly is this hint, as is so true with so much of the lost colony, that gives us a little taste of what might be going on, but we can never quite nail it down.
Andrew Lawler. His book is called The Secret Token. On Tuesday night, he's going to be at Weller Bookworks at Trolley Square in Salt Lake City. For details, go to our website, radiowest.org. We'll take another break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER.
Is something missing from your morning breakfast or evening dinner prep? How about NPR's critically acclaimed sound-rich stories alongside KUER's in-depth local news? Now with smart speakers, listening just became a whole lot easier. Tell Alexa or your Google Home to play NPR, and they'll take you right to KUER's live stream. Unlock the world of public radio with just your voice by telling Alexa or Google to play NPR, and never get stuck in the driveway again.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now to our conversation with the journalist Andrew Lawler. We're talking about his story of the lost colony of Roanoke. His book is called The Secret Token. We know that when the colonists landed, that they, as you say, set to build a proper English town, not a temporary camp. So there was a lot of stuff. They had a lot of equipment and things and garbage. They had plates and pots and guns and chests and shovels and wheelbarrows. And yet hardly any of that stuff has been found. Let's talk a little bit about now the modern archaeological work and what we know and what we don't know. Why hasn't there been more things, do you think, discovered, uncovered, found?
It's such an odd thing. And remember, there was a 1585 expedition with more than 100 men who initially established this settlement on Roanoke Island. And then the lost colonists arrived 2 years later, and they rebuilt it and reestablished it. So, you know, in total, you had well over 200 people, not to mention the sailors and Native Americans who were passing through and visiting. So this was a very lively, active town. This wasn't just a makeshift settlement. And, of course, they would have left tons of trash, if nothing else. I mean, one meal of oysters leaves a pile that doesn't go away easily. So there would have been thousands and thousands of artifacts, tens of thousands of artifacts left behind by these two groups of English who lived there for at least a year or more each. So this is one of the odd things. Where did it all go? So we don't know where the lost colonists went, but we don't know where they left from.
Yeah.
You know, that's been the great archaeological mystery of Roanoke Island. And since the 1890s, archaeologists have been attempting to locate the settlement. There is a fort there. There is slight remains of an earthen fort that had been interpreted as being the remains of the 1585 expedition that was there on Roanoke. But there are some archaeologists who dispute that, who aren't convinced that it's necessarily an Elizabethan fort. And the embarrassing thing, of course, is that this fort forms the centerpiece of Fort Raleigh National Historic Site, which is, you know, the place where Americans go to celebrate what in some ways was the spiritual birthplace of this country. And yet even the fort itself is not clearly, absolutely Elizabethan. Now, what happened? Well, some archaeologists maintain that they just haven't looked in the right place, and this fall there will be additional excavations there by the First Colony Foundation to try and seek evidence of the settlement. Now, geologists, on the other hand, they say good luck because they believe that given rising waters and changing currents, that the north end of Roanoke Island has been washed away, that well over 2,000 feet are gone, and therefore the settlement probably is gone as well. But I don't think the archaeologists are going to give up because we do know that they did find a small workshop that was built in the 1585 expedition that was used by the first practicing Jew in the New World, by a man named Joachim Gans, as well as Thomas Harriot, who was an English scientist. So we know we do have that one piece that we know comes from the Roanoke voyages, but that's the only unequivocal archaeological evidence we have.
Mm. We should say John White's maps of eastern North Carolina turned out to be pretty good. And there's this intriguing revelation that in looking at these maps, and you went to London to see these drawings, there were these patches on the map.
Yes, and in 2012... a University of North Carolina professor noticed something odd. On the map that John White drew of eastern North Carolina, he noticed two patches, and he asked a question that nobody had asked in four centuries. What's under the patch?
Right.
And finally, the British Museum, which has the originals, put this map on top of a light table. And sure enough, one of the patches turned out to be a mistake. That, in other words, John White hadn't drawn a coastline exactly as he wanted, so he went back and redrew it, and you know, on top of the patch. Yep. So that was clear, and that was done back then. But then they looked at the other patch, the one to the north, about 50 miles inland from Roanoke Island. And what they discovered there was fascinating, because underneath this patch was a clear image of a fort, a Renaissance-style fort. And on top of the patch, well, you could say, well, maybe that was a mistake. Maybe they intended to build that fort, never did, so John White covered it over. Well, no, because on top of the patch, they discovered something even more interesting. There was the light outline of a fort on top of the patch drawn in invisible ink,
yeah,
which they believe was made with urine, as yeah. a matter of fact,
yeah.
common invisible ink of the day. So what this says is that the English were trying to hide something. From whom? From the Spanish, of course. The right. Spanish were eager to get whatever information they could in order to destroy these English enemies who were threatening the livelihood of Spain's fleet. So naturally, the English wanted to hide something. So that would suggest that there was something to hide.
Let's talk about Virginia Dare, the most famous American about whom so little is known, as you say. This is John White's granddaughter. Interesting that he doesn't say much about her, only mentioned her once, and I think you say only in passing. But you mentioned how, as you did your research, her name all of a sudden kept coming up, and you kept seeing her name again and again. And Virginia Dare becomes a really important part of this story.
Yes. What we know of Virginia Dare is that she was, as you say, the granddaughter of John White, the governor. Eleanor White and Ananias Dare were her parents. She was baptized in August of 1587, and that's where her story ends,
yeah.
when John White departs on his way to England. No European ever heard from her again. So as far as we know, she might have died a week later. Infants often did.
Yeah.
But the story of Virginia Dare grew into this, you know, sensational, wildly popular story in the 19th century. And I was curious as to why. And so when I went back to find the kind of the original mention following John White's account in the 1590s, it wasn't until the 1830s that her name really appears again. And it was women who resurrected her. What I mean by that is that a woman who was from Boston, who was a writer. Remember, this is a time when the first women are beginning to make a living as writers. The first women's magazines are being published in the 1830s. And a lot of women were able to write and make a living working for these publications. So one of these women was looking for a figure in American history, a woman in American history, in colonial history. And if you try to name an American woman prior to the Revolution, it's hard to come up with one.
Yeah.
Pocahontas? Mm-hmm. So this woman, who had written several historical novels, decided that she would pick Virginia Dare, the first English child born in the New World. And she wrote a series of magazine articles about Virginia Dare growing up to be this beautiful blonde-haired, blue-eyed woman, teenager living in the woods of Roanoke Island. All the other colonists had been massacred. She's good with a bow and arrow. She wears a doeskin, and the Indian braves are crazy about her. But of course, she remains virginal, remains pure,
yeah.
and later is in later versions of the story is turned into a white doe by an evil Indian shaman. Now, these stories, of course, are all made up. They're all legends that were created in the 19th century in this romantic era. But they became really popular well into the 20th century. Mm. So by the 1920s, there are dress shops named after Virginia Dare. There's a wine named after Virginia Dare. There's people named their children and boats after Virginia Dare. She becomes this really important cultural figure. And I was curious why.
Yeah.
And when I began to look at the timing of when this came about, I started to piece together this larger story.
It's interesting. The Raleigh voyage comes to be seen as a way of reinforcing the ruling race's domination. And it's interesting in that story you were mentioning, that magazine story, where Virginia's turned into a doe. She's wounded, and as she's dying, her final words basically curse the, quote, red men of America. It's pretty interesting. What does that mean, do you think?
Well, keep in mind that the 19th century was a time of great anxiety among white Americans. As people were beginning to move west, the Indians were displaced. In fact, thousands and thousands of Cherokee and Choctaw and others were forced west of the Mississippi. And their story is really tragic. And this was being done so that white planters could move in with enslaved Africans and create the vast cotton fields that made the South so wealthy. And at the same time, these enslaved Africans created troubles as well because they might revolt. And in fact, in the 1830s, the Great Slave Rebellion led by Nat Turner took place in Virginia, not far from Roanoke Island, by the way. And whites were terrified around the country that blacks were going to rise up and really destroy white society. So there's all this concern as well with immigrants coming in. This is the first period when this strange new religion was arriving on American shores called Catholicism. These Germans and Irish arriving who were very different. So for the white Protestants of English and British heritage, this was a very unsettling century when the complexion, literally the complexion of America, was changing radically as African Americans and immigrants began to form a larger group of people in the country. And Virginia Dare, suddenly I realized, of course, she's the little white girl abandoned on an island surrounded by dark savages. She was, in essence, a way to express that anxiety that although whites were in charge and white Protestants were still running the country, there was real concern that this was a tenuous foothold, if you will.
It's also interesting that Native Americans lay claim to the Virginia Dare story, too.
Yes, and this has a lot to do with the 19th century as well and the politics of the moment. For example, the Lumbee Indians of southeast North Carolina were said to have taken in the lost colonists following their being abandoned in 1587. And in the 19th century, they were renamed the Croatan Indians, and they were given their own school system. This is important because after the Civil War, if you were Indian, your situation was bad. But if you were an African American, it was worse. And the Indians did not want to send their children to African American schools, which were terribly underfunded. So the legislature in Raleigh agreed to name these people the Croatan Indians and give them their own school system. And in exchange, they switched their votes. They were Republicans, that is the party of the minorities, the party of Lincoln, to the Democratic Party, which was the party that was run by whites. So it was a really clever maneuver in order to get the Native Americans to agree to the white power structure, if you will. So that's where this story of Roanoke is fascinating, because at every age it offers us insight into what was happening during that particular era.
Hmm. This surprised me, I have to say. Virginia Dare makes a comeback in the weeks before the 2016 election of Donald Trump. And a conversation that you had talking with one of the white nationalists who supported Trump, a man who was fascinated with Virginia Dare.
Yes, and Virginia Dare was a symbol of white supremacists. And when I use the word white supremacy, I'm using the term that was common in the 19th century. This is a term used by people who identified themselves as white supremacists. Virginia Dare's birthday celebration on Roanoke Island in the early 20th century was basically a white supremacy rally. People would come and they would talk about the importance of maintaining a white dominance and white supremacy and ensuring that the barbarians didn't control the country. And of course, that was a reference to Native Americans as well as African Americans. So this was a very well entrenched tradition. It's all there in the records. It's all there in the speeches that were given at this annual celebration. So I guess it's no surprise that that there's nothing new under the sun. Mm. So in recent years, when white supremacy has made a comeback in this country, and discussion of that is certainly a hot topic, we find that Virginia Dare herself is being revived. So in a way, I think it really shows that my thesis works, that Virginia Dare is a way to the interest in Virginia Dare is a way to track our anxiety about race and immigration. You can visit that website, vdare.com. Yeah. It's an anti-immigrant website, and see for yourself. But I think it's a powerful message that this legend says a lot about who we are and who we want to be as Americans.
Yeah, that's kind of where you end up. You say this is a good myth because it's a myth that allows people to kind of rework it and adapt it to the time. Maybe we'll still use this story. Maybe we'll still use Virginia Dare. That's not going to go away in that sense, I suppose.
Well, the beautiful thing about legends is that they do shift and adapt based on the stories we need to tell ourselves. So Virginia Dare has been a symbol for feminists. For example, you know, here's a woman who lives in the forest and is doing just fine without men. Thank you. So, you know, there's a lot of ways to view her story that isn't necessarily about white supremacy. Francis Ford Coppola, the film director, not long ago bought the rights to the name of Virginia Dare wine, and he's busy producing that wine in Sonoma Valley in California. In fact, I'm going to be going out there shortly to give a talk. And, of course, I was one that had to inform him that Virginia Dare has this other side of her. But from his perspective, you know, she's a piece of American history that is simply something to celebrate. You know, the arrival of Europeans here is not something to be completely ashamed about. So I think there are many ways to view Virginia Dare, and that she will shift and change as time goes by.
Andrew Lawler, his book is called The Secret Token: Myth, Obsession, and the Search for the Lost Colony of Roanoke. He's going to be giving a reading on Tuesday night at Weller Bookworks in Salt Lake City. We have details about that on our website, radiowest.org. Radio West is a production of KUER News, the show produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.